I'm sorry?
It wouldn't put up. I've tried it a second time.
Mr. Holbrook?
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Holbrook, representing Dick Heller, Ab Jordan, and the other plaintiffs. With me at council table, Richard Gardner and Dan Peterson. In this case, the District of Columbia responded to the Heller decision by enacting the most restrictive, radically restrictive firearms law in the nation. And it did so under the assumption that the right in question is not a fundamental right, and therefore only a deferential, reasonable standard of review applies. And the district
applied intermediate review.
Pardon, Your Honor?
The district court applied intermediate
scrutiny. Well, the district court said that it was applying intermediate scrutiny, but in actual fact, it simply relied on a committee report and disregarded all the sworn evidence submitted by the plaintiffs, and I think it really simply, in fact, it used the word defer several times in regard to the allegations in the committee report and the necessity for all the restrictions in the law. We think that one of two approaches is appropriate, namely either the categorical approach that was applied by the Supreme Court in Heller. Under that approach, the question was the right infringed? And the court said, even without looking into a specific standard of review, that it was. The court did reject rational basis and did reject the interest balancing test proposed by Justice Breyer. And in fact, Justice Breyer's the case law that he supported in support of the interest balancing test was really the intermediate scrutiny analysis. Now, the court in the McDonald case made clear that the right is fundamental, thereby pulling the rug out from under the district's argument that it's not a fundamental right, and therefore this deferential reasonable test applies. The district court said the right was not fundamental when it went on to actually reject the reasonableness test, but then applied what it called was intermediate scrutiny. There's two basic aspects of the district law. One is not just a simple registration system, but the most onerous registration system nationwide. There's no state that actually has universal registration of all firearms other than Hawaii. And in the case of Hawaii, there's no expiration. Once you're registered, that's it.
What about municipalities?
I believe Chicago may have a law where the registration expires after a certain number of years. The district enacted a expiration provision where if you don't re-register the firearm every 3 years, then you're in possession of contraband and in criminal violation. But I'm not aware of any other jurisdiction that has an expiration provision.
But those jurisdictions, Hawaii and some Chicago and perhaps some other municipalities, require registration, initial registration.
Not of all firearms. There are some jurisdictions that register handguns, but not rifles and shotguns.
And that includes Hawaii.
Hawaii is the only state that has registration of all firearms.
Chicago and some other municipalities.
Chicago is one that's identified.
Municipalities do so, they're acting under authorization from their state, correct?
Well, not necessarily. For example,
they may be rogues, but if they're validly acting, it's because they have delegated authority from their state.
Well, no, because, for example, not on the issue of registration, but on the issue of alleged assault weapon bans, Columbus, Ohio, has a so-called assault weapon ban, but that state has preemption, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit has declared its assault weapon ban unconstitutionally vague in a case called People's Rights Organization versus City of Columbus that I argued. So even though it's still in the books, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is authorized by the state.
What did you say about New York City?
New York State?
New York City.
Well, the city has a licensing requirement for handguns, It does require either
long guns, right?
A premises permit or a carry permit for handguns. It also actually has a registration system for some firearms. I'm not sure that all firearms are included. I don't think that was discussed in the briefs, but there could be a universal registration requirement. We focused on looking at state law and not necessarily what every city required.
Well, what, you did this in the course of in several respects. One was to determine whether this was within the range of usual police regulations of firearms under the D.C. code. And I think also in respect to whether these were these were reasonable restrictions by looking at what other jurisdictions
yes, Your Honor.
Do. So how do you decide to focus only on states and not on cities when the District of Columbia is, as a practical matter, an urban area, a city?
Well, if we use just cities as an example, Chicago had a handgun ban as well, and that was invalidated in McDonald. So it's not necessarily the case just because
it's a ban. I understand the bans are out. But in thinking about what we now have, registration requirements and limitations on hardware.
Well, let me put it this way. We're maintaining that the registration requirement is inconsistent with exercise of the core constitutional right in the home. But even aside from that, there are aspects of the D.C. registration regime that go beyond any city even that we know of, particularly the expiration provision. It also requires training and vision tests and all kinds of other requirements, fees, fingerprints, photograph, the kinds of requirements that exist to some extent under federal law to possess a machine gun. The National Firearms Act imposes registration requirements on machine guns, which are not considered constitutionally protected under the discussion in Heller, for example, and that's why the government is allowed to require them to be registered. The court has...
Is there argument that for registration requirements that they must be long-standing under Heller?
That was one test that Heller used.
That's the only test Heller used, isn't it?
Well, it did use that as a criteria, a historical criteria, but on the other hand, some of the regulations that exist under federal law that... that Heller said were presumptively valid were not necessarily longstanding, maybe depending on what you mean by longstanding. Certainly they didn't exist in the colonial or the founding period. In fact, the Federal Gun Control Act of 1968 is where a lot of these provisions first are enacted, although some of them existed at the state level, bans on possession by felons, by mental incompetents and whatnot.
Well, I think that's what Heller means by longstanding in state or federal law. When it articulated the four exceptions to the right.
Correct. And there's no longstanding tradition of requiring registration. There's no longstanding tradition of banning firearms under the derogatory term assault weapon. We have in the record that there's over 2 million of the Model AR-15 type rifle been produced. Heller talks about a common use test in terms of whether the type of firearm is one that is constitutionally protected. The district has nothing on that in that regard but a committee report which has allegations we refuted with hard evidence. The committee report said these rifles are not in common use. They have no data, and they also said that these rifles are designed for military purposes, and our evidence showed that there's no military force in the world that uses them because they're only semi-automatic rifles. They're not full automatic rifles, which every military force in the world use, and which is a preferred tool of terrorists and criminals in some cases.
Mr. Halberg, in that respect, you've just cited two examples of points taken, the district court, on which the district court relied, taken from the legislative report, which raise what you're describing as empirical claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
But some of the report on which the district court relied seemed to involve simply law enforcement judgments about whether having to reload would be, whether if an assailant had to reload would be helpful to police, whether ballistics tracing would be helpful to police. Surely that is something that they don't have to document empirically.
Well, on the reloading issue, the test will be whether magazines that hold more than 10 rounds are in common use by Americans for lawful purposes.
Well, insofar as the court relied on the three-second delay being helpful to reload, being helpful to law enforcement.
Right, but the
district court was in solid ground deferring to the police on that, don't you?
Well, the court deferred, but that has to do with persons who are a threat to law enforcement. And we're coming here representing law-abiding people, and these magazines are in common use.
So what, you're looking for a ruling that applies only to law-abiding people?
Well, it's a fact that magazines of this type are not banned virtually anywhere in the country, and they can be purchased in Maryland or Virginia or any other place. And to say that that Absalon Jordan cannot have a magazine that for his handgun that's constitutionally protected that holds 15 rounds seems to come under the categorical test that the Supreme Court applied in Heller.
Heller's focused on self-protection in the home, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so is it fair a game to view the magazine limitation in terms of whether that ban significantly compromises one's ability for self-protection in the home with a 10-round magazine?
Well, we have evidence in the record that having a magazine that holds more is useful for self-protection, is useful for defense in the home.
Some might be even heavy artillery, but the question is whether it substantially impairs the right of self-defense in the home doesn't depend upon. It seems to me a relative question because it depends on what's left, doesn't it?
Well, DC's provision or argument presupposes that a person has multiple magazines and can change them. Many handguns are sold with one magazine.
So a prohibition on multiple magazines would be on a different footing?
Well, even if we're talking about the right to have more than one magazine, if there's an emergency in the home, the person's going to be nervous enough without having to change magazines. It's like in the Supreme Court argument, the Chief Justice asked about fiddling with the trigger lock because Solicitor General Dellinger was, you know, talking about how easy you can take the trigger lock off, but your hands are shaking and you're trying to get the light on and all kinds of things are going on. So, I mean, the fact that the Metropolitan...
Sounds like you're saying it doesn't even have a rational relationship to...
We don't think that it does. If we assume there's a right to protect oneself in the home, and on those same lines, if I could turn the court's attention, because you mentioned the reasons articulated in the committee report, the reasons for registration, I think the reason that's most suspect is the one that says, so we can arrest people who have unregistered firearms.
I was amused by the brief, I don't think it was the district's, that pointed to the pre-constitutional law of England that prohibited Catholics from having weapons as a justification for bans on weapons.
Well, the district...
That was the whole point of the Second Amendment, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The district cited the law of Charles II of 1660 that required gunsmiths to report gun purchasers to the Crown, followed by a law 2 years later saying that the Lord's lieutenants can search and seize houses for firearms of persons who might be not friendly to the king. And these were the same laws that the court in its historical digression in Heller talked about that were that George III tried to do the same to the colonies.
Do you have the same problem with licensing laws that you do with registration laws? In other words, licensing the person as opposed to registering every gun?
Certainly, that's more narrowly tailored than what we have here. In fact, you could even have a registration system that only had to do with the person's name and not necessarily each and every firearm that was at issue. But licensing, generally speaking, has to do with carrying firearms and not merely possessing them in the home. Mm-hmm. The standard, basically, in this country is that there's a background check on every purchaser of a firearm. And once you're cleared, there's no registration system. But if you want to carry a firearm in public, a whole different set of rules apply. And that's been very longstanding in terms of our nation's history, either banning concealed weapons or requiring licenses to carry concealed weapons, and in some states openly as well.
The historian's brief produces quite a list of prohibitions along those lines. But hearkening back to the law of the district before the Supreme Court's Heller decision, it was impossible, it was unlawfully to carry a gun in the district to put it in your home, correct?
Well,
just to buy it in Maryland or Virginia and bring it to your home would have violated the law.
That would have violated the law.
So how does a law that protects only possession in the home give anyone license, as it were, to bring a gun from another place?
Well, for example, district law does require you to bring the gun to the Metropolitan Police Station to be tested and for examination. And so that's an exemption in the law. There are other laws. There's a federal law that preempts state and local law in terms of transport of a firearm for lawful purposes.
So that would shield the person getting it to their home?
We don't challenge any aspect of D.C. law in regard to transportation. We don't see that as a big problem. It does prohibit carrying a gun on the person.
And there's an impressive array of historical precedents in the historian's brief, isn't there?
As far as licensing, what the historian's brief...
with regard to carrying or carrying concealed.
That's correct, Your Honor. But not in regard to mere possession, certainly not mere possession in the home.
There was one, I think it was the Hawaii one, actually.
And that their Supreme Court upheld that law under a rational basis standard. They have identical language as the Second Amendment, and they applied a rational basis standard that we know is not the correct standard of review.
Can I ask you on your statutory argument? So the theory is that a 1906 federal law allows D.C. only to impose usual and reasonable gun laws, right? And so the key word is usual here, I would think.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what I think that's an interesting argument, and I'm going to ask opposing counsel a lot about that, but why hasn't that kind of challenge been raised before now? You know, I'm wondering why, sitting here in 2010, after all these years of various gun laws, that there hasn't been a challenge. Wait a second. This provision is unlawful under the 1906 federal act that limits the scope of D.C.'s authority to enact gun laws.
Well, there has been a challenge. Side by side with the Heller case, it was another case called Seegers versus
right.
Ashcroft, and
right.
That was my case, and we did raise that issue. And the case ended up being dismissed on standing grounds.
So it's never gotten to a merits determination.
There's never been a merits. That criteria exists in regard to other laws of the District of Columbia, and there are cases we cited in the brief that invalidated some of those laws. And I think the focus should be on the word usual. Reasonable is a little bit more vague, but this is a most unusual law, to say the least.
Right. Usual would mean customary or ordinary, and so... this is not an ordinary law in terms of the states of the United States.
It's certainly not. There's no state law of this type, and we may pick and choose and find a city or two that has something like this, but that's unusual.
Well, doesn't whether it's usual or not depend upon the level of generality with which you've asked the question? I mean, if you say vision tests, I think Chicago may be the only other instance. If you say registration, we're talking about several. If you say firearms or small or long guns, it's a larger group. How do you know what, in fact, why wouldn't we take the most indulgent standard of generality here?
Well, the fact that something exists in a few places might mean that it's an unusual law. One thing that comes to mind is the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments in the Supreme Court cases about death penalty for juveniles and persons with low rates of intelligence. You could have a third of the states even that have the death penalty in those cases, and the court said that was unusual. So It's certainly highly unusual to have universal registration, to have particularly the expiration of it, and to ban all the guns that they call assault weapons. There's no other so-called assault weapon ban that is onerous. This one bans not only the list of firearms, but it ends the clause by saying any firearm that the chief of police finds is against the public interest. So
California and New York and a few other states ban a lot of semi-automatic rifles, correct?
Well, they're quite different. First of all, their statutes generally define the term much more narrowly than the District of Columbia. Secondly, they allowed registration and grandfathering of all existing ones that existed in those jurisdictions. New York and Connecticut in particular did that. So California is probably the furthest one out, but it still allowed registration of those that existed on the part of persons who had them at the time the laws were passed or shortly thereafter.
Among your challenges, I believe, are the expiration, the three-year expiration, and the six-year background check. Is that right?
We didn't really challenge the six-year background check per se. We do challenge the expiration. It would seem that once even if the registration system itself is valid, that's way out in extreme for exercise of a...
Why is that a ripe controversy?
Well, if we talk about narrow tailoring, for example, first of all, you've got the only reason they've cited that is because your vision may go bad or you might be convicted of a crime. First of all, you're checked for a criminal record or mental illness and all that when you buy a firearm. And secondly, if we're talking narrow tailoring, you could even have a firearms identification card system where a person's a firearm owner. They could still do a background check in 6 years if they wanted to do that. There's ways to...
Right, but you're objecting to the license expiring every 3 years, and no license has expired here. No license is imminently going to expire.
Maybe this is one of those cases if you're going toward the standing issue.
Well, the rightness aspect, perhaps.
It's going to happen invariably with every one of these cases, and then the question is, what do you do? And if they store the guns in Virginia, then the court will say they don't have standing because there's no imminent prosecution because they're not in violation. So that's one of those, like in certain First Amendment cases, it's going to come up and it's going to repeat itself. And it's something that...
Well, the 3 years will inevitably pass. Whether these plaintiffs will be interested in renewal or be alive or be in the District of Columbia is conjectural.
No, it's most probable they'll still be here and they'll be alive.
Well, we wish them well, of course.
but if we delay that, then we're only delaying an issue that ought to be resolved. I mean, and also all the other elements of
constitutional issues ought not to be resolved unless they have to be, right?
That's accurate, and that's why we've given you a statutory basis if you wish to resolve the case in that way.
Is there any real significance, any substantial difference in the two? In other words, how could we say, well, yes, I guess there is the usual aspect. You haven't emphasized the reasonable aspect of the statutory requirement.
We think that's important.
Isn't that essentially duplicative of the constitutional inquiry?
Probably would be, although we also look at Congress's intent and not necessarily just the constitutional requirements and Congress's intent of what Congress deems to be reasonable. You look at the history of how they've rejected registration over and over throughout the years. They've passed laws depicting the right to keep and bear arms as a civil right.
So something could be unreasonable even though not unconstitutional. But not vice versa.
Absolutely.
Not vice versa. It couldn't be unconstitutional and yet reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Under your theory, the 94 federal assault weapons ban is unconstitutional, right?
First of all, assault weapons were defined very narrowly in that law. In the district law, they're defined very broadly. And, in fact, that law was more on paper than reality because it grandfathered all existing ones. So it's a very, very different law than the districts. And so one could make an argument, which I'm not making, but one could argue that a much more narrow law would be a different story. I think it did raise constitutional problems, but it was never resolved because the scope of it, given the grandfather clause, and given the fact that the narrowness of the definition, the firearms companies could get into compliance with that law very readily just by removing one feature that was not even essential, like removing a bayonet lug or something that was only there for cosmetic purposes.
The distinctions of the 94 law are the grandfather clause and the narrower scope of the covered or banned weapons. Right? Is that what you said?
I'm saying that that law is so different than the district's law that one could argue more readily in favor of that law in terms of meeting constitutional standards than one could argue in favor of the D.C. law. But I wouldn't make that argument. I think that the law did violate the Second Amendment, but it was never resolved in by a court of appeals anywhere.
Any more questions? All right. We'll give you a couple minutes. Mr. Kim?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Todd Kim for the District of Columbia. Our Constitution guarantees a right to keep and bear arms, but not to keep guns secret from the government or to possess military-style weapons and high-capacity magazines. The Second Amendment does not prevent legislatures from enacting gun laws like those at issue that further important public safety interests without meaningfully burdening individual self-defense. This Court should affirm the District Court's rejection of plaintiff's Second Amendment claim either because the Second Amendment, properly understood, is not implicated by the gun laws at issue, or because, even assuming otherwise, appellants' call for strict scrutiny or an even stricter rule of per se invalidity is unsupported by normal constitutional principles and, in fact, inconsistent with Heller itself. First, let's turn to the categorical arguments about whether the Second Amendment is even implicated by these laws. A gun law may not implicate the Second Amendment based on three different principles. First, consistent with Heller, the gun law may be akin to what the Heller Court called a presumptively lawful regulatory measure. Second, as Judge Ginsburg indicated, it may not significantly compromise protected conduct, and so the burden may be too trivial even to infringe the right. And third, the gun may not be a protected arm under the test developed by the Court in Heller and Miller and this Court in Parker. Again, all three of these principles have application in this case. If we can turn first to the registration system, we believe that the basic requirement to register a gun is consistent with the right. If we look at its original public meaning, I think the history shows, given the gun laws that were in place at the time of the framing, that people would have understood the right to be consistent with government measures to survey gun ownership by the people.
Where do you get that?
I get that from three different sources, mm-hmm. and there's no significant dispute that these particular laws existed. Mm-hmm. And I would parenthetically note that as Judge Easterbrook wrote for the Seventh Circuit in the Skoyan case en banc, a presumptively lawful regulatory measure need not precisely mirror right. measures that were in place at the time. The legislative role did not end in 1791, is what mm-hmm. Judge Easterbrook said. So let's look at three particular parts of the history. The first is door-to-door gun censuses, described by Professor Churchill in her seminal article. Second, loyalty oaths. Without taking an oath of loyalty at the time of the Revolution, people were deprived of certain rights, including the right to bear arms. And third, we have the fact that militia laws undisputedly required those appearing for militia musters to present their arms for inspection.
They had to present all their arms or just bring an arm?
They had to present the arms that the government required, which
right.
I think
they didn't have to bring all the guns they owned.
No, not necessarily. No,
right, so it wasn't a registration requirement of all arms.
No, but I think a few things we should remember. First, militia requirement reached a broad portion of the people, and I think that's undisputed. So its distribution across the populace was not meaningful.
Well, I'll stop you there. People over 45 were not covered. Mm-hmm. People under 18 presumably owned firearms, and women.
That's all correct, Your Honor. I would note that as Professor Churchill described, this is at page 148 of his article, in the states at the time, even those who were exempted from militia duties could be required to keep arms of certain sorts. And he describes that at length. It's in Connecticut, New York, Virginia, various other states. Mm-hmm. But I'd go more broadly to the point again that the laws in place at the time need not precisely mirror the laws in place today for it to be akin to a presumptively lawful regulatory mm-hmm. measure. And I think what the laws we've discussed were intended to achieve and the level of intrusion that they posed suggests very strongly that the district's basic registration requirement, which we believe is non-intrusive, we can talk about the particular further aspects of the registration scheme later, but I think what it strongly suggests is that the original public meaning of the right would have been understood to be consistent with such measures. And let's remember the history as well.
Just before you go on, clarify for me how you're connecting to the current laws.
Sure.
A requirement in the revolutionary period, a requirement that one have guns, not a limitation on having the guns.
Absolutely, but these measures were not merely part of that requirement. I think what the measures show is that the people understood that the government had the ability to see how the people were armed. And again, let's
make sure they were armed and well armed, correct?
That's certainly part
and
of
that
it.
That was a requirement.
I think it goes further than that, though, Your Honor, with all respect. Let's remember that what was facing our young nation at the time. As the Constitution reflects, the militia was valuable for things like suppressing insurrections and repelling invasions. It was crucial for the young government to know how the people were armed because that was the major source of arms for the militia. So accordingly, I think it would have been quite surprising to people at the time to think that the government couldn't survey how the people were armed.
It was also reasonable in the circumstance you described to have them swear their fealty to the new government.
Yes, and obviously...
But you wouldn't say that today, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
The district doesn't require it. You don't have to pledge allegiance to the flag to get a gun.
No, we don't require that.
Okay.
Certain other things.
So because those circumstances no longer obtain.
Correct, but I think
if we were fighting a war on North American soil, they might very well be reasonably reinstituted. But we're not. So again, I'm at a loss to see why requiring people to have guns during a time of insurrection or revolution has any bearing on this.
And again, I think what's important to remember is that what should control here is the original public meaning of the amendment. And we think much as the original public meaning of the First Amendment would not be thought implicated by laws regulating obscenity, we think laws requiring people to tell the government how they're armed simply do not implicate the Second Amendment. But this court need not so conclude in order to uphold the registration requirement. As I've discussed, appellant's entire argument here rests upon the premise that strict scrutiny or this even...
I just don't... Stop again. I don't see the evidence. I've looked at your briefs and the amicus briefs and done a lot of other reading, and I don't see the evidence that registration of all firearms or classes of firearms was required by any state or the United States at the time of the founding.
I agree with that, and again... We're not saying
okay,
that there's
so
a direct
registration. What you're doing is reasoning by analogy from the other laws. And Easterbrook approach. Okay.
Correct, Your Honor. But what I was going on to say is this court need not even go down that road in order to uphold the basic registration requirement. Appellant's entire argument is premised on the notion that strict scrutiny or an even stricter rule of per se invalidity should apply, and we don't think that is correct. It's inconsistent with normal constitutional law and indeed inconsistent with Heller itself, we believe. First, let's turn to the...
If we take Heller and McDonald on their face, what those two cases say are long-standing regulatory measures are permissible. And then it gives some examples. But the word long-standing is the test. I don't think strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, all the debate about the labels matters.
I respectfully disagree. I think the court did indicate that certain long-standing exclusions would be relevant in the Second Amendment analysis. It did not preclude, though, the fundamental notion that even when one of those exclusions does not apply, the government may be able to justify a certain gun law through application of a level of scrutiny, be it strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, or some other level. So I think there is no statement in Heller that those wouldn't apply. I think quite the contrary. Let's turn to their notion that no arm may ever be banned. I think that's inconsistent with Heller. In two different spots, the Heller court makes clear, I think, that some level of scrutiny will apply. In discussing the district's handgun ban, which is, of course, quite different from the ban on assault weapons we're talking here in terms of its breadth and its impact on self-defense, but in that passage, the court expressly notes, under any of the standards of scrutiny that we have applied to enumerated constitutional rights, the handgun ban would not stand. I think it would be quite surprising for the Heller court to have included that language in the opinion, but really to have meant there can be no level of scrutiny applied to any ban on an arm. I think consistent with normal constitutional law, much as certain forms of speech may be banned under certain circumstances, perhaps very narrow circumstances. But appellant's argument that no arm may ever be banned is simply inconsistent with constitutional law and Heller itself. And I must emphasize that they have forfeited.
On the arm being banned, I think their argument, there are two different tests here. For the registration, I think the test is that they're articulating is the longstanding, has to be a longstanding measure. On the banning of arms, as I understand it, Heller says you can't ban arms that are in common use.
I respectfully disagree again. I think the Heller court.
That's the argument. I wasn't saying that's the. I'm not positing that. The argument is that Heller says that you can't ban.
I respectfully disagree with the argument.
Yeah.
I think the Heller court envisions a two-part test. Mm-hmm. First, of course, is the question whether the weapon in question is in common use such that it's an arm. Mm-hmm. If it's not in common use, it's not an arm, the Second Amendment has nothing to say
so
about it.
So machine guns and sawed-off shotguns are out under
right.
that.
And there's no need to consider any of the traditional levels of scrutiny.
Right.
And I think the second part of the test is precisely that. What level of scrutiny should apply, and has the government met that level of scrutiny? But appellants, I should note.
Your theory is that certain classes of arms, even in common use, may still be banned if the government has a sufficiently strong interest.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's consistent with Heller. And I must emphasize, appellants forfeit any argument that the bans on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines would fail even strict scrutiny. Their entire argument is that no arm may ever be banned. If you look at their briefs very carefully, I think that makes it very clear. We even say in our brief that they forfeit that argument. There's no response to that in our reply brief. So if this court rejects the notion that no arm may ever be banned, ever, then that's as far as it needs to go to reject their Second Amendment claims as to the assault weapons and high-capacity magazines bans.
What? You're saying that they're arguing that no arm ever can be banned?
Yes.
They're not arguing that.
I believe that's precisely what they're arguing, Your Honor.
I thought they were arguing that Heller has the listed exceptions for machine guns and dangerous and unusual weapons.
Yes, I think they're raising, they have to show two things under their theory of the case to win as to these bans. The first is that no arm may ever be banned, and the second is that these are arms. Now, we believe that assault weapons on this summary judgment record were properly concluded by the district court not even to be arms, and we can discuss that. But I think this court needn't go that far. Appellants have framed their case in this way, and this court can accept that framing. Turning to the registration scheme, even if this court disagrees that it is akin to a presumptively lawful regulatory measure, we believe that strict scrutiny should not apply to the registration scheme or any of the particular aspects of that scheme that are challenged here. It's very important to recognize the reasons why we believe strict scrutiny should not apply, even if this is a fundamental enumerated right. Much as the Supreme Court has said with regard to commercial speech, because it is an area traditionally subject to government regulation, strict scrutiny does not apply there. There are many areas of constitutional law involving fundamental enumerated rights where strict scrutiny does not apply. That is why the Third Circuit and the Seventh Circuit have already rejected the application of strict scrutiny to particular Second Amendment claims. We think this court should do likewise here. The most important reason being what I think is the largely undisputed fact that since the time of the framing and before dating back to England, the government has broadly regulated firearms and always has been recognized to have legitimate authority to do so. To adopt strict scrutiny, I think, would be inconsistent with the original public meaning of the right and with the framers' intent, in that it would expand the right beyond what they could have envisioned. Strict scrutiny, with its attendant presumption of unconstitutionality, would be inconsistent with this nation's traditions. There are other reasons why strict scrutiny should not apply here, but this court need go further than that.
Can I ask you a question on the class of arms, again, on the banning of the semi-automatic weapons in the magazine? We know that the district can't ban handguns,
correct?
Many of which are semi-automatic. And we know that the district can ban machine guns, automatic weapons.
Correct.
This is semi-automatic rifles we're talking about here. And the question is, which is the better analogy? That's one way to approach the case. Which is the better analogy in terms of the reasoning of Heller? Isn't the government's interest in banning handguns very strong, even stronger than the interest in banning semi-automatic rifles? Heller said, not good enough.
I think the Heller court obviously rejected the handgun ban.
Mm-hmm.
And I think an argument could be made that the government interest in banning handguns is just as compelling, if not more compelling.
Far more compelling because of the concealed nature of being able to carry them on the street.
Right, but of course, we also know that the interest at issue under either a handgun ban or assault weapons ban is compelling. The real rub of the matter is whether the particular ban is narrowly tailored to that interest. So I think the notion that the government's interest may be more compelling with regard to handgun, even accepting that, wouldn't necessarily be relevant here.
Mm-hmm.
And going again to the Heller case, because I want to make sure I address all your concerns there, I think you're right that the Heller court said that handguns as a class may not be banned. And you indicated that the handguns do include, the class of handguns does include semi-automatic handguns. The Heller court did not say that semi-automatic handguns may not be banned. It didn't say that any particular subclass of handguns might not be banned. Of course, the district,
Think there's a lot of room in Heller for that, so I don't know if you want to go there. But,
yeah. I'm making just the point about the analogies you were trying to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you did want to draw analogies, I think it is much closer to a ban on automatics than a ban on all handguns. Handguns are, according to the Heller court itself, the quintessential self-defense weapon, and the Heller court goes in some length as to why handguns may be preferred for functional reasons. Assault weapons, I think the council legitimately concluded, are not self-defense weapons. They're offensive weapons. They're very useful for offensive
weapons. What was the basis for that conclusion? What was the evidence on that?
I think the main basis was the testimony of witnesses at the council hearings, including the testimony of a Mr. Brian Siebel from the Brady Center.
And did he have anything other than his opinion to offer?
I think it was not only his opinion, but he had citations to a lot of literature on the matter. And if you look, let me take a step back. The Supreme Court in the Florida Bar case indicated that even strict scrutiny can be satisfied at some times, not with empirical evidence, but based on history, consensus, and simple common sense. Assault weapons, we think the council had very legitimate reasons to conclude, are not useful for legitimate self-defense, but are very useful for things like mass murder and police shootings.
Why aren't they useful for self-defense?
I think there are conceivable applications for them in self-defense, but to say that they're superior than other generally available weapons for self-defense is not supported on this record.
Was that the test?
They
have to be superior to other self-defense weapons?
Well, I think if we're asking what I think the Heller court was asking us to ask, which is whether the particular law at issue meaningfully burdens self-defense, then I think, yes, we should be considering that.
So going back to a question I asked Mr. Hellbrook then, you think the court should look at a restriction, the imposition that a restriction makes on self-defense in the home, by evaluating what alternatives are still open?
Yes, I think that is part of the analysis the court should undertake.
Now, this is a fundamental right. If we were asking ourselves, can the state restrict speech, let's say by making it a misdemeanor to use certain enumerated curse words, I wouldn't think that would be something that we could uphold on the ground that people can express the same thoughts using other words.
Well, I agree with that. I don't think that would survive.
How is that
a first
not analogous
analysis.
Here?
Well, two broad points. First is that attempts to analogize First Amendment principles and import them into Second Amendment principles should succeed only to the extent that the values we're trying to protect under these two amendments are similar. The First Amendment obviously is quite different from the Second Amendment. Speech and self-defense both have value under the Constitution, but for different reasons, and the courts should recognize the differences. First Amendment in particular protects things like free expression and spontaneous free expression. The Second Amendment, by contrast, isn't about freedom of expression, it's about self-defense and also about protection of the militia and perhaps other things we needn't discuss right now. So I think we have to be very careful when we attempt to analogize the First Amendment to the Second.
Well, is there any fundamental right that can be compromised lawfully because there's some alternative that's adequate to serve that right? How about restrictions on abortion? Would you say, could the court uphold a restriction, the Supreme Court uphold a restriction imposed by some state on the ground that it's easy enough to go to the neighboring state?
I don't think so. And of course, there's a difference in a hypothetical regarding going to different jurisdictions. We're just talking about the district's law here and what it...
Well, but as a practical matter, it's, you know, the question is whether the ease of easily accessible alternative is relevant to the, in assessing the burden imposed by the law in question.
Sure.
Well, it could be a county. I mean, if a county imposes some restriction on abortion, then people, would they say whether the public bus will take you to the next county?
I don't think that would fly.
I don't think
it would fly either.
Can you think of any example where the availability of an easy alternative is relevant?
Well, sorry to come back to the First Amendment, but of course, when a legislature adopts content-neutral restrictions on speech that are time, place, and manner regulations, strict scrutiny does not follow. It is some lesser scrutiny, recognizing that the ends that the First Amendment was designed to protect are not squarely implicated. Obviously, the courts will still look closely at a time, place, and manner regulation, but the question becomes whether it survives the appropriate scrutiny. We think the Second Amendment should not be different in this regard. There can be different means of exercising a particular right, and I should note, the Second Amendment does not protect a right of guns, it protects a right of people. And if the people can protect themselves just as well with other weapons, I don't think the Second Amendment should be an impediment on the legislature.
Well, it says to keep and bear arms. It doesn't just say the right of the people to protect themselves.
Correct. Correct, Your Honor.
So it's a little more specific than what you just articulated, I think.
Agreed. Yeah. Duly noted. But I think it doesn't change the analysis here, which is that appellants' only end that they are seeking to protect here is self-defense. Mm-hmm. And if they can defend themselves just as well with other weapons that do not pose such significant public safety concerns, I don't think the Constitution requires a federal court to overturn a legislature's considered judgment on this point.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I was going to ask a question about the statute. The statute, as I understand it, the 1906 Act prohibits the district from adopting gun measures that are not reasonable and usual. And assuming, and you may want to challenge this, but assuming that act still governs in terms of the framework under which the district can adopt gun laws, the question for me is whether these laws are usual. And usual usually means either customary, traditional, or ordinary in the other states, the Eighth Amendment jurisprudence being a good example. And these laws seem, by the district's own admission, to be the strictest in the country. And not usual, rather not ordinary, but rather extraordinary. So why are the district's laws consistent with that 1906 Act?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm wildly out of time, so if I can...
We have plenty of time.
Wonderful. I do too.
Judge Kavanaugh has a question, we have the time.
All right. But if I can just not only answer your question, but also address the fundamental underlying premise that that statute constrains...
Please, because I found that very interesting, but also very confusing.
Sure. Mm-hmm. First, addressing your question, I think precedent from this court and also from the D.C. Court of Appeals, which gets deference on in terms of interpretation of local district law, indicates that whether a law is...
Does the D.C. court get deference on the interpretation of a federal law?
It can. It depends.
I don't think so.
This court, of course, all district laws in some sense...
No, I meant a congressionally enacted law.
Yes, it can, and it does. This court has recognized in cases like Bliley, that it, when you're talking about the Home Rule Act.
I thought Bliley distinguished deference we give to D.C. courts in interpretation of D.C. passed law from interpretation of laws passed by Congress.
I don't believe so. I think the Bliley case indicates...
Depending on which capacity Congress was acting when it passed the law.
I think that is going to the analysis I was trying to go towards. The Home Rule Act, for instance, is a hybrid statute. It involves both federal aspects and local law aspects. We agree that the D.C. Court of Appeals gets deference only as to the local law aspect. But I think that's the whole point here. I think this court, I think it was the Fireman's Insurance case, deferred to a D.C. Court of Appeals interpretation as to a grant of authority to the council. I think similarly here, the D.C. Court of Appeals should get deference as to this. But I don't think it matters because I think this court, as well as the D.C. Court of Appeals, going back to your question, have suggested at the least that whether a law is usual does not depend on whether it has precise analogs in other jurisdiction, but rather just whether the type of subject matter that's at issue is addressed by other legislatures of other jurisdictions. And that's what the district court found here. And I don't think appellants meaningfully come to grips with that holding by the district court. But if I can, I'd like to go to the fundamental first question here, which I think appellants don't meaningfully respond on. This court needn't consider what the 1906 statute would have allowed a prior district government to do. History has gone much further. Of course, the district government is not the same as it was in 1906. In the Home Rule Act, Congress chose to give the district's council far-reaching, broad legislative authority over all rightful subjects.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's why I'm surprised to see that 1906 Act still codified.
Oh, but I think that raises a very interesting point. I'm sorry I didn't have room to get into in our brief, 14,000 words being 14,000 words. It's codified, but mistakenly codified. The public laws at issue have not been amended, and the public laws are the actual law. The codification, as this court is aware, is merely prima facie evidence of the law. If you look at the actual public laws, they still refer to the commissioners. The commissioners. The reason that Congress didn't amend it was because it didn't have to. All functions of the commissioner, including regulating firearms, were transferred to the council for the council to have broad legislative authority on.
Right, and then this provision was edited to substitute the mayor and the council for the commissioners.
But not by any legislature. Evidently, the codifiers of the D.C. Code did that.
But it was pursuant to the Home Rule Act, correct?
I don't know why the codifiers did that. I think it probably would be more accurate for them not to do that. Mm-hmm. Even more fundamentally than that, even
the question is, does the restriction in the 1906 public law passed by Congress still bind the District of Columbia or not?
Agreed. That would be the question. But there are two fundamental reasons why it does not. The first is that it's never been amended, and the Board of Commissioners no longer exists. Mm-hmm. And the council has the authority on the Home Rule Act to reach all rightful subjects of legislation. The second is that the 1906 statute on its face is not a limitation. It is a grant of authority. It says the commissioners shall have authority to do this. The council could choose its sources of authority, and if it had authority under the Home Rule Act, it could act under that authority. And indeed, in the committee report underlying this particular statute, the 1975 Act we're going back to.
Isn't it then just surplusage in the D.C. Code?
It may be. It may be. But this court does not resurrect surplusage in the face of clear congressional intent to give a local legislature home rule authority.
Well, I just don't see any indication in the Home Rule Act that I found that Congress intended to eliminate the 1906 Act. And your question of authorization versus limit is an interesting one, and one that's not easy either.
Right, well,
but I certainly was expecting to find some indication somewhere that the 1906 Act no longer binds the district.
Right.
And I didn't find that.
Well, as opposing counsel indicated, the district court in the Seegers case did reject appellant's argument here. And I think more fundamentally, the absence of precedent on that may be because, sorry, but it's just not a particularly good argument.
No, I meant the absence of any indication in a congressional report and elsewhere.
I think it's taken as a given by everybody who knows about the district that the district's council has broad legislative authority. I mean, to take the implications of their argument.
That no doubt, everyone agrees on that. The question is whether, with respect to gun regulations, they have to be reasonable or unusual or not.
Right, and you'll note that Congress at times, or individual members of Congress, have attempted to introduce new gun laws relating to the district. And notably, they have never been relying upon this particular argument. But I also want to go and sketch out the implications of appellant's arguments, because I think they're unacceptable. Mm-hmm. This is not the only provision still codified in the D.C. Code that gave the district government reasonable, unusual, or usual and reasonable authority to do particular things. If you look at the other grants of authority and apply to appellant's argument to them, it would mean the district's council didn't have authority to do things like broad-ranging authority to do things like protect the safety of the people in the district. Mm-hmm. It is precisely so that the district could legislate like that without the need to involve Congress that Congress adopted the Home Rule Act.
What about the idea that, okay, for those provisions, interpret them flexibly, broadly, but this provision raises serious constitutional questions. Laws under this provision raise serious constitutional questions, and so as to avoid those, we should construe the reasonable and usual test a little more stringently here.
I don't believe that the canon of constitutional avoidance applies here for two different reasons. The first, we think the constitutional arguments are clear and we should prevail on them. But second, and more fundamentally, the canon of constitutional avoidance is not applied in that fashion. You don't misconstrue one statute to avoid a constitutional issue on a second one.
Well, that's, yeah. obviously, but the question is whether the first statute's ambiguous in this case, I guess.
Right, but whether it's ambiguous or not, the ambiguity should not be resolved on the basis of a constitutional issue regarding a completely separate statute.
I take it you have no concern with whether the expiration of provision is ripe for consideration.
We haven't raised that. I think the court properly raises a concern with regard to ripeness. We didn't address that in our brief, but of course it's a jurisdictional issue this court could consider sua sponte. For all the reasons we discussed in our brief, we think the council was completely within its rights to protect public safety in this manner without meaningfully burdening self-defense. We think that this court should affirm in all respects. We thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Kim. Mr. Halbrook, give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Judge Ginsburg. If I could just make three brief points. First of all, we don't claim that no arm can be banned. In Heller and in the case of U.S. versus Staples, the Supreme Court drew the line between ordinary rifles like semi-automatics and machine guns. And in the Heller case, the court talks about, as this court did in Parker, rifles, pistols, or handguns, and shotguns as being the ordinary constitutionally protected arms, and that machine guns were not constitutionally protected. And in Staples, the court was concerned specifically with the AR-15 rifle, the very kind of model that we've submitted evidence on common use here, and it made clear that that kind of rifle is the kind of arm that's possessed without any idea of wrongdoing by Americans throughout the country. So the Supreme Court has drawn the line. And by the way, in drawing that line, if we go back to U.S. versus Miller, and both on its face and as interpreted in Heller, what was the issue in terms of arms that were not constitutionally protected? What were they not protected from? And it was a registration system. The National Firearms Act required registration of short barrel shotguns and machine guns and whatnot. And that's the reason for the court disposing of the case the way it did in that case. And if I can just quickly say something about the Enabling Act, aside from repeals by implication being not favored, the McIntosh case that we've cited, the D.C. Court of Appeals case, specifically refers to the 1906 law in terms of whether D.C. gun laws have to go by that restriction. And in fact, in a number of cases we've cited, both this court and the D.C. court system cites those same enabling acts that refer to usual
and reasonable. It still reappears, but what about Mr. Kim's point that those acts, the 1906 act in particular, was an authorization and not a limit, and therefore it may be surplusage now, but there's a broader authorization to the D.C. City Council in the Home Rule Act?
Well, we think it's still part of the statutory provisions, and when there's a specific way that Congress tells D.C. they have to regulate, the one that applies specifically, not some more general grant of authority, is the one that would apply. So,
well, that's one way to look at it, but one way to look at it is there's an earlier authorization by Congress to go this far, and then there's a later authorization by Congress to go even further, and therefore the earlier authorization essentially is subsumed within the later, broader authorization.
Well, that's not the way that law or the other laws with that same language have been interpreted by this court or by the D.C. Court of Appeals.
I hear you on that. Yeah.
So thank you, Your Honor.
Further questions? No. Thank you, Mr. Halbrook. Mr. Kim, thank you. Case is submitted.